There is a myth that Aboriginal people used to attach feathers or bits of fluff to workers and follow them back to the hives. That might have occurred after European honeybees were brought to Australia and maybe went feral. And I've tested this with some native bees where I thought to find where they're nesting, I'll stick a little bit of tissue paper or cotton wool to them and follow them. But I found that they resented having something stuck to their backside. And they would just land on a twig and try to scrape it off, and they weren't going anywhere, thank you.
Welcome, and you're on another environmental adventure with Understory this ninth day of October 2019. I'm Elizabeth Poe. Some live in trees, some in the ground. Some create spiral artworks. Others make little pots. Some look like wasps or even flies. And if you know your bee story, they all arose from wasps in the distant past. And in Australia, bees are so diverse, we are aware of more than 2,000 species. They are worth looking at and searching for with descriptors like carpenter, leafcutter, mega mouth and blue banded. Some people get the native bee bug and follow them around as much as they can. And one of those native bee experts spoke to Understory recently.
My name is Terry Houston. I'm born in Adelaide in South Australia. Moved to Queensland for a time to do university studies. Went back to Adelaide, became a herpetologist, a bit of misadventure. Then found a job in entomology in Perth and have been here ever since. I was at the Western Australian Museum as curator of insects for 34 years, a job that I very much enjoyed. But I'm now retired from that and I'm enjoying retirement, continuing pretty much what I was doing before, except without the responsibilities.
And one of the reasons we're talking today is because you recently published a book on Australian bees, native bees, and it caught my imagination, and I think it's caught a lot of people's imagination, because they are fairly invisible, and perhaps there's a lot of people who didn't even know that we had native bees, and certainly not how many types we have.
Well, that's correct. Yes, I did publish a book. I was invited to write the book for CSIRO Publications, because I think there was a general feeling that because of the great interest in bees these days that we needed a book on Australia's native bees. And having studied them virtually all my life, I was an obvious choice.
The fact that there are so many types of Australian bees is remarkable. Recently I heard of the blue-banded bee and the mega mouth and these new discoveries that are happening that you're part of as well.
Yes, well, you're right, Elizabeth, that there is a great diversity of Australian native bees. So we can only estimate the number at this stage at around 2,000 species. And I think it's closing on 1,700 species that are now formally described and named. But we know that in collections there are large numbers of species yet to be named and described. And virtually every trip I do out into the bush, I discover at least one more species that we add to the undescribed heap. They're so diverse in their form. Some do look like honeybees or similar to honeybees, but very many bees look more wasp-like. They could be confused with other insects. People tend to confuse some flies, like bee flies and bees. So, yes, it's a difficult matter to distinguish them sometimes, and that's where the book comes in handy. They vary a great deal in their habits as well. So we have bees like you mentioned, the blue-banded bee. That's a generalist in terms of the flowers that it visits. So it will visit both native flowers for pollen and nectar and also some garden exotics. But there are other bees that are somewhat more specialised, and you're only going to see them at their preferred flowers, whether it be, say, a group of flowers like eucalyptus species, or perhaps just one species. There are extremes where bees will visit just one species of plant. So some bees are also extremely tiny, around about 3 millimetres in length, so they generally go unnoticed. They are. But they're still clever little creatures. Even being so tiny, with so little grey matter, they still are able to build homes, leave them to forage, and then find their way back home to drop off a load and go off for another load. So I find that amazing, that they need so little brain, and yet they carry out complex behaviours and have quite special abilities, being artisans and building their nests. Some of their work is just beautiful. It's exquisite work, so neat.
Wow. How do you tell the difference between a wasp and a bee?
Well, this is tricky because bees essentially are a specialised, well, they're a group of wasps that have changed from being predatory to being vegetarians. So instead of preying on insects or spiders and stocking those prey items for their larvae, they collect pollen and nectar, so they're strictly vegetarians. So that transformation from predatory ways to vegetarian ways occurred with very little change in morphology. So they are very wasp-like in appearance for obvious reasons. They retain the sting for defence in most cases. But to distinguish them, if you're unsure, you've really got to get them under a microscope or at least a strong hand lens and look for branched hairs on the body. That's the only reliable feature that will distinguish bees from wasps, that bees have branched hairs. Wasps have just simple hairs.
And is that something to do with the vegetarianism?
It may be that the branched hairs help to hold pollen grains on the body. So that's the most likely reason why. There was another transformation from a group of wasps, a different group of wasps, became vegetarian and started collecting pollen and nectar, but they didn't develop branched hairs.
Oh, no.
And we don't call them bees. We call them pollen wasps. But their behaviour is very similar to some of the bees.
Understory brings you part of an interview with renowned entomologist Terry Houston, who has studied Australian native bees for more than 50 years, both in the field and in state museum collections. He served as curator of insects at the West Australian Museum in Perth for 34 years, and although now retired, he continues his bee research in an honorary capacity there. Inhabiting the Perth region is around 80 species, which are highly dependent on the native flora. New bee species keep coming to light and some fascinating behaviours are found. However, the rapid destruction of bushlands in the region means that some species are becoming scarce, and without adequate conservation of the diverse vegetation systems of the region, some are at risk of extinction. Dr. Houston is the author of last year's CSIRO publication, A Guide to Native Bees of Australia, a beautiful coverage of the estimated 2,000 species of Australian bees. I asked about changes he has seen.
Talking to people, especially young people, like school students, and I've been mixing with some Year 2 pupils just recently, I find they are very aware on environmental matters. And it really surprises me because that is such a contrast to when I was a kid at school. And yes, during my lifetime, I have seen great changes in the environment, especially in the expansion of Perth suburbia into what were once beautiful bushlands where I used to roam and collect insects. So habitat loss is something that really concerns me, because insects are important, and often we don't appreciate that they may become more important in the future than they are now. So,
in what way?
I mentioned that some bees are specific pollinators. Some plants need those specific pollinators to produce their seeds. And if those plants suddenly become important, perhaps we need chemicals that they produce, or perhaps we will decide that horticulturally they're very attractive and we want them to be grown en masse, you may need those pollinators. And if we don't know where to find them and how to manage them, we may not be able to grow those crop plants. Apart from native bees, insects have also proved to be very important in terms of biological control around the world. So some things that Australia has found extremely useful to control weeds in Australia, they were just nondescript, seemingly unimportant insects in some other country, and if those countries had let them go extinct, well, we wouldn't have those biological controls. So I think we've got to look to our future and try to retain as much of our biota, our biodiversity, as we can. There's an estimated 20,000 species of bees in the world, and of course honeybees, there are just a few species of honeybees, mostly tropical species, and it's the European bee that's been domesticated and spread worldwide. But amongst those wild bees, there were the bumblebees. They occur virtually around the world, but not in Australia. There are a number of groups of wild bees which have not made it to Australia. Anyway, bumblebees have been disappearing in parts of the Northern Hemisphere, and so there's been great concern about them because they're alternative pollinators. And they are also more efficient pollinators for certain kinds of plants, more efficient than honeybees. So take, for example, plants of the tomato and potato family, the Solanaceae. Many of those plants have buzz-pollinated flowers, so the bees have to vibrate the stamens to shake out the dry pollen. Honeybees don't have that ability for some reason. So if you want efficient pollinators for tomato plants, you're looking at either bumblebees or blue-banded bees are very effective. They can buzz flowers, as can many of the native bees or wild bees, if we're talking bees outside Australia. If we lose the honeybee, of course, we're looking, well, what other bee could we turn to? So there are some other Apis species, that's the genus of honeybees, but they may be affected in the same way. In fact, if it's a pesticide problem where the chemicals get into the pollen that the bees then collect and store in their nest, there may be no bees that are immune to them. So we need safer pesticides or some other means of pest control.
It reminds me of the insect population collapse that was reported on a few months ago. And do you know much about that and what that indicates and how we can respond to that?
I'm afraid I don't know a lot about it. I've read a little, but it was a projection based on a limited number of intensive surveys that were done over long term. And you don't get many surveys that are done over long term. Most studies tend to be short term. But they did plot their results and it indicated that insect populations, generally speaking, were declining. Now, there can be many reasons for that. So habitat loss is the obvious one, but then there are many other factors like climate change and the use of pesticides, pollution and so on and so on. But in Australia, I don't know that there is any solid evidence that insect populations in natural habitats are declining, other than casual observations that, you know, because of drought, there's a lack of flowering, and so the nectar-seeking insects don't do well. So I think it's probably a given that, given human effects on the world, that insects and most forms of natural life are going to be declining, thinning out at least. So it saddens me that that's the way we're going. And will we ever arrest the decline? I just hope that at some point we will manage to stop the endless growth.
The sound of native bees buzzing a flower may be familiar, and you can hear the difference between their buzzing of a flower for its pollen and the lower pitch of their flight. The recordings you hear in this program are captured in New South Wales by Vicky Powers. We are so grateful for the growing access to information about our local native flora and fauna in dire situations of species loss and threat of extinction. And learning to love our environs is a radical action to practice every possible moment, as I've been relearning as I spend time watching and listening if I have any native bees in my vicinity. It may take a while.
How do you follow bees? How do you track them? How do you find out where they're going back to? Like when you were a child and you watched and you thought, where do they go? How do you find that?
I've relied on just putting my foot in the right place at the right time, just being an opportunist. And sometimes when you're standing still in the bush, you might hear a bee hovering around your feet, and when you look, you see, oh, it's homing in on a hole, and plop, down it goes. And looking around, you might find more holes. So if you want to follow bees, these days there are some high-tech solutions where you can put tiny little chips on their backs.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yes, they can be radio tracked. The technology is beyond me. I have no use of it, but people are doing these things.
Amazing.
Yes. At least if you see the insect has loads of pollen on the hind legs or under the abdomen, you'll know that it's a bee, because there are no other insects that carry loads of pollen on their bodies. But yes, it can be tricky. So buy my book, that's what I say.
You've been with Understory, meeting with Dr. Terry Houston, who has a native bee named after him, as well as being the author of the fascinating Native Bee book from CSIRO. Also published last year was a photographic book of Australian native bees by James Dory. The books complement each other well. Dr. Houston was speaking with me, Elizabeth Poe, and thanks to Adrian Glamorgan for assistance. You can re-listen to this program, as well as many others, and also share them around by finding the Understory page on RTRFM. Just Google Understory blog. And we'll be on air again, same time, same planet next week, as there's always more to explore on Understory.com.